and welcome to Film Shake. I'm Jordan.
And I'm Nick, though I will call myself Nicholas in any promo that we do. I can't live up to my own standard of naming myself.
Today we're doing episode one on Nick's pick, Ugetsu Monogatari, from 1953, directed by Kenji Mizoguchi. But first, before we get into that, we're going to just talk a little bit about the show and what we plan to do. Our idea is to keep it short and to the point. The tagline I came up for for the show is short takes on great movies.
I like that. It's very snappy.
Snappy. We're trying to keep it snappy here. Just a quick 30 minutes, spoiler-free on any film that we watch and talk about. Even for these older films like that, I want to keep it spoiler-free because I know for me as a listener, if I see a podcast come up on my feed and I've never seen that film, I'm probably not going to listen to that pod if I know they're going to get into like the nitty-gritty. I'd rather watch the film first. But what I like about what we're doing here is kind of giving you like a taste of movies that we really enjoy or that we've experienced and maybe motivate you to go and watch those things. For those people that have seen it, we're still going to give you a good rundown and discussion on the film itself. So it's a good mixed bag, I think.
And if you haven't seen the movies, you can learn whether or not you hate us over the course of a few weeks, right? Or a few months, because we're going to say, oh, that was a great movie, and you're going to go in spoiler-free and then say, oh, that was terrible.
Yeah. Why did you recommend that?
Jordan and Nick are idiots. Hopefully that doesn't happen.
I don't think so, especially with this film and the type of people that would ever even consider watching it.
That's funny. I was looking in the mirror and practicing for this podcast and making up false conversations of questions I would hope you would ask me, one of them was, so who would be interested in this movie? And then I would say, well, Jordan, I read this really discouraging article the other day that said that millennials in general have only seen one to two films from before 1980.
Yeah, that's pretty depressing.
That's really sad. So when you ask someone, are you interested in this, you have to start off with this. Okay, well, the film is black and white. Are you okay with that? So that eliminates, like, you know,
what, like 80% of the population? That's right there.
Well, the film is totally spoken in Japanese with only English subtitles.
Is that a problem? Yes.
If you can get past that, do you like surrealist anti-war films?
Ah, there you go. There's the kicker. That just drives the nail in the coffin there.
Surrealist anti-war, I'm done.
Yeah, I want pro-war realism. Give me the Hurt Locker.
I don't know. Give me some guns.
Yeah. Well, let's first I wanted to get into real quick just that we're part of the 25th Frame podcast network. They've invited us in to join them. We'll be on their website and their main feed, like through iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. So you can check out their website, 25thframemedia.com. Lots of great other shows you can dive into there. So a little bit longer than ours. So if this kind of whets your appetite, then you can go and get into all the things over there, all the film stuff.
That sounds great.
Yeah. We're also with EBRPL, it's East Baton Rouge Parish Library. I'm actually a librarian with the library, and they're letting me record this on work time, which is nice.
They're so great.
Yeah, because we have a film club that we're trying to push people towards, and we also have a space where you can record your own podcast. So it's pretty neat stuff. If you're interested in that, give us a shout out at EBRPL.com. Good deal. Well, Nick, tell me a little bit about why you picked Ugetsu for this podcast. What was interesting about it to you?
So there was this ping pong ball in my mind, and it was bouncing off all the walls of my brain. And I thought, what would benefit me here? What have I not watched in a while? And I realized I haven't watched many foreign films lately. Then I thought, well, what else have I not watched lately? I haven't watched many films from the past. And I'm on that dividing line of Gen Xer and millennial. I'm literally like born in the last month that someone could consider themselves a Gen X according to like the census. So, and I had a weird childhood. All that to say, I've seen a ton of you know, foreign classic cinema, but none of Mizoguchi's movies, never. I haven't seen a single one of his films, and yeah. I don't know why his name just popped in my head, and I thought about the film that always looked the most enticing. Maybe it's just like that, like really sensual DVD cover, because I don't work at the library now, but Jordan and I worked together at the library a long time ago, and my job when I wasn't on the desk was cleaning all of the damaged DVDs, and I saw, I think, every movie that we had in stock there.
Probably so, yeah.
But I never watched this.
Yeah, this is the first Mizoguchi for me as well. He's a huge blind spot, and so I'm really excited to get into this and to watch more of his films, hopefully through this podcast as well.
I feel like late high school, late 90s, I went Kurosawa nuts just because I heard that he influenced the original Star Wars movie. And
right.
then I watched like every Kurosawa film, like yeah. even like his later stuff in color. And I think I kind of like just paved over that place in my mind that was like, watch classic Japanese cinema. I really only watched a lot of Kurosawa films.
Right. Yeah.
And maybe a couple of others. So.
Yeah, that's how I feel. Mainly seen Kurosawa. Recently gotten into Ozu with like Late Spring and Tokyo Story.
I would love to do some of those later.
Yes.
Late Spring, I always had in my hand at the library and then I'd put it down. And
so you've never seen
something
it?
Else. I've never seen
good,
it.
Good, good. Yeah, we can definitely get into that. Big fan of that movie. Just a little synopsis about Ugetsu Monogatari, also translated as Tales of the Moon and Rain. It's set in the civil wars of 16th century Japan. Two ambitious peasants want to make their fortunes. And one, we have the potter Genjuru. He intends to sell his wares for vast profits in the local city, while his brother-in-law, which I didn't really get that from watching the film, but...
That was his brother-in-law?
Yeah.
I just thought they were wacky neighbors.
Yeah, same here. Apparently that was his brother-in-law, Tobai. He wishes to become a samurai. And their village is sacked by marauding armies, Genjuro's kiln miraculously survives, and they and their wives head for the city. However, Genjuro soon sends his wife, Miyagi, back home, promising to return to her soon, which is totally messed up. And Tobai, in his keenness to follow the samurai, abandons his wife as well, Ohama. Meanwhile, we have a wealthy noblewoman, Lady Wakasa, shows an interest in Genjuro's pots and invites him to her mansion.
So let's get into Genjuro and Tobai. Genjuro is sort of like your basic, like, his wife tells him, like, really early in the movie, they have a child, they have a son,
right.
I don't know, 3 or 4 year old. And they're a happy family, and she tells him at one point when he brings her back a nice kimono, you know, I love this kimono, but what I love more is that you thought of me to buy it for me.
Right.
And I love, you know, basically us being in harmony as a family. And then, of course, with this film, and so often in life, him being a man, that's not enough for him. He
right.
wants glory and riches. Disaster ensues, but his buddy there, Tobai, he's more of the dreamer.
Yeah.
He's just this goofy, clumsy guy, but he thinks he can be a samurai. He has no formal training as a samurai.
Yeah.
He has no ability with a sword, or I mean, he can't really walk without falling over.
Right,
but
right.
he's convinced he could be a samurai.
He's constantly like like groveling on the ground, like running around in the dirt. So yeah. But he's definitely like a buffoonish character.
That's right.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking about the contrast between Genjuro and his wife, Miyagi, how interesting that is. I feel like this film does a really great job of defining its characters, like, very early on. Like, in that first scene, we kind of know exactly who everybody is.
Yeah, before they even leave the village.
Right, right. There, you know, obviously there's a theme of ambition and greed, where he's wanting to profit off the war and go sell his wares in the city. And his wife is just wanting him to be safe and to stay with her and their child. I love, like you said, that scene where he buys her the kimono and she's telling him, you know, I just want to be together with you. And his face, he doesn't even seem to hear her. He's not even thinking about that.
He's just
that,
looking,
you know?
Off into the distance, yeah. of, I could buy her an even nicer kimono.
Right, right. And it's all about them. I like how Mizoguchi balances it with, you know, yes, they're ambitious and they're greedy and they do abandon their wives, but at the same time, I feel like he does make it human to where their desire is not just to, like, be great for their own sake, or, I mean, it is for their own sake, but it's so they can, like, come back home and, like, be proud and boast to their women. You know, which it's not necessarily cleanses them of any of their mistakes.
No, it's not really any better, but
right.
they're real humans.
Yeah.
They're not just caricatures of, oh, look at these dumb, greedy guys
right.
who don't care about their family. They're very human.
Yeah, it's it's a relatable desire, you know, to want to prove yourself as a man and to come back and show yourself strong, you know. So I feel like he definitely captures a realistic edge there to their characters.
Yes. Unfortunately.
Unfortunately, horrible things happen to just about everybody. I did want to talk just about Mizoguchi first, him as a director and kind of his renown, you know, where this film comes from. Or at least what I kind of interpret from some things about his life that you can really see show up in this film. So he's definitely one of the big three Japanese directors, you know, along with Kurosawa and Ozu. He also made some other great films, or at least highly regarded. Again, I haven't seen them. Sancho the Bailiff, Life of Oharu, which was kind of his big breakout internationally that won the Silver Lion at Venice Film Festival.
Which this film did as well.
Yeah, this one did as well.
I enjoyed that Ugetsu's first shot is just of the Silver Lion award that it won.
I was like, did they film that just for the movie after it won? Or was that just like, you know, it's stock footage thrown in there?
It's definitely like the same grain of film as the rest of the movie.
Definitely wanted you to see and to know that he won the award for this. But yeah, he's kind of one of those big directors that helped break out Japanese cinema. Like Ugetsu and Rashomon were both kind of like the two films that brought Japanese cinema to Western audiences. So this is a highly regarded film. You know, it's on the top 10 list of like Godard and Tarkovsky and Scorsese, like all these well-known directors. It's also been on the Sight and Sound poll. It was in 62 and 72. So it's kind of dropped off since then, but it's got a long history.
People forget.
Really? And yeah, sometimes there just needs to be like that restoration or that screening to bring it back to critics and, you know, people's minds to say, oh yeah.
That's kind of something I want to get into with this movie. I think there's sort of a sense with every generation that the previous generation didn't know anything. Whatever they achieved will achieve better things in them. And then you just kind of forget how major some of the achievements that happened before us were. And with this movie, even just on a technical level, the camera movements, there's a shot where the families are fleeing a roving army early in the film, and the camera tracks through the woods, which I can't tell if it's a set or real woods. If it's a set, it looked beautiful.
Yeah, it looked like a real wood to me.
And just the camera movement through it is so technically proficient.
Yes.
It didn't take me out of the film because I was absorbed with what was happening. But I did rewind it and watch the camera movement again just because it was so smooth. And
yeah.
I even heard, because I did, of course, my research after the movie, which I'm glad I did, so I didn't spoil anything, that I think this was the only film that the director complimented his cameraman on.
Right.
He never gave him a compliment otherwise, but I think he just kind of elbowed him and was like, hey, nice job.
And definitely big props to the cinematographer, Kazuo Miyagawa. And he went on to work with Mizoguchi on many other films. But yeah, I read the same thing. And yeah, the cinematography in this is so well done and so smooth and beautiful. And that's what Mizoguchi is really known for, is those long, unbroken takes with the gliding, roaming camera. You know, like the first shot, the camera is moving before we even get started. Like it cuts and it, you know, you cut from that Silver Lion medal or whatever and like all the credits. And then the first shot, it's already moving. And he doesn't hardly ever stop moving throughout the film. And I just love that. And watching that and thinking about long takes and tracking shots or moving shots, it made me want to ask you, what is it about moving the camera and tracking shots and long takes that cinephiles gravitate to? I feel like that is kind of a staple of being a cinephile, is like you love those like long Kubrick tracking shots. Yeah.
It's crazy because is it A Touch of Evil? Was that the Orson Welles film that starts with a long tracking
shot? The 8-minute or 12-minute shot, whatever it is.
I remember watching that and honestly, like going back and just looking at it rationally, it seemed like it was just like a very run-of-the-mill like film noir. But that opening shot is just so technically incredible. And you know, I mean, just the way that guy's brain worked, that he storyboarded this out and he saw it all in his head. I think maybe that's it. Because that's a clear sign of genius.
Right.
Doing things like that.
It's definitely, it's showy, and I think that's why we tend to gravitate to it, because it does show off their prowess as a filmmaker. Like, this was obviously really hard to make, and if you could pull this off and do a great job, then that proves something. But I think it also, like you talked about when you're watching that wood scene, you didn't feel like it brought you out of the film at all, but you did want to rewind and watch it. So I think a good, Mizoguchi is a good example, obviously, where it is technically proficient and very showy and, like, very masterful and obviously genius. But there's depth, and it also just immerses you in the story too, where you just you're brought right into that environment and that setting with those characters.
Most definitely, because I feel like that could also be a crutch, because, for instance, in Touch of Evil, after that awesome tracking shot, I just found myself continuously distracted. Like, Charlton Heston's not a Latino.
Exactly. Yeah.
Even like, I need to watch this film again. Children of Men.
I was thinking of Children of Men. I mean, obviously famous for that long tracking shot through the building.
But I kind of wonder what it says, that when I watched it in the theater, it blew my mind. It did, and yeah. I own the movie, but I've never rewatched it.
I've rewatched it a couple times. I do need to go back and check that out again. I did want to mention with Mizoguchi as well that, and we'll see this in Ugetsu, how he was a very progressive director as far as it comes to his portrayals of women.
What I was going to circle back to.
Oh, you were going to circle back to that?
Yeah, yeah. There's this sense, again, like, I don't want to just be like, dumb millennials, because really people like call people who are like 14 years old millennials, and they're not. And I mean, my wife is most definitely a millennial, yeah. And I'm barely not a millennial. I'm not going to diss millennials.
I fall in the millennial category, yeah, I believe.
Exactly. Yeah. You and my wife are like 3 months apart, I think. But there's maybe, and I mean, Generation Z is probably on Twitter more than anyone, and that's my son's generation, so I don't want to insult them. But you get like this sense, just from, this is more of a media thing really than a generational thing. You know, this sense of outrage, like, no one was woke yesterday. People are just woke now.
Yeah.
No one ever knew that these great offenses against, anyone who's underprivileged or not a white male, no one ever noticed before that was going on. But now we know. If you watch this movie, I didn't have any prep before I watched it. And about 3/4 of the way through, I'm thinking, what is this about? Because he's flipped genres a lot of times, because there's a horror movie very deep inside this movie on multiple fronts. There's a realistic horror movie, which is, what happens to one of the wives because of the husband's negligence.
Yeah.
But there's also, I've got to look at her name because I don't want to say it wrong, Lady Wakasa.
Yeah.
There's a supernatural horror surrounding what she brings to this film.
Yeah.
So I found myself thinking, like, well, this is really like hypnotic. The camera movement's great, all the stuff we talked about. But what's the point of this? And then it just suddenly becomes very clear, in that last quarter of the film, like, oh, man, like, these guys, are awful, which isn't, like, just an indictment against the characters. That's very human nature, unfortunately, the things that they do. But, because of their actions and because they just pushed the women in the film to the side, and just completely like subjugated them to their own desires. They brought ruin, and it's not just an indictment against them. I feel like the entire film is more of a national indictment.
Yeah,
I think because this is a post-war film, obviously. This is coming after World War II. And there's a line which I think quoting it is not going to spoil anything. A character says, "Don't let my suffering be in vain. Pull yourself together and work hard." And there's like a smoldering countryside around her when she says it. Yeah. And there's a scene where weapons of war are being discarded. Mm-hmm. And at that moment of the film, I was like, wow, this is an indictment that, with Me Too going on now and sort of like mainly people in power in Hollywood that are being exposed, this is kind of the thing that he's shooting at way back in 1953, and very blatantly and boldly. There's not that, like, this isn't a subtle film or that it's just a totally surface film, but if you're paying attention to the movie, there's no mistaking that that's what he's going for.
Yeah, I mean, I think even right from the beginning, when we stay in the village with Genjiro's wife, Miyagi, you'd almost expect from a film this old and just from, cinema language in general, that we'd stay with the men. That's an unfortunate assumption I think we would we would place on a film. I mean, you know, historically, most films have been about men. But I love that we stay with Miyagi, and that in that next scene, after the men have gone off to sell their wares in the city, we have her talking with the village chief and how he's complaining about, you know, Genjiro and Tobai's greed is going to, you know, like quit. They're trying to make a quick buck during war times, and that kind of thing doesn't last. He even, you know, quote says they're too greedy for their own good. Quick gains in chaotic times never last. A little money inflames men's greed. So like right there from the beginning, we have that same indictment of their greed and how we're staying with the women characters, seeing how that is playing out with them. And then, of course, you know, we kind of go back and forth over the film between seeing the men and their actions and then seeing, you know, how the women are left on their own. And that throughout is just telling us that story of how women have suffered because of war and the effects of war.
And I think it's important to note this is a 66-year-old film, and maybe a danger of now, and maybe we're kind of already seeing it where, like, maybe certain people that committed some pretty ugly, you know, offenses as far as harassment or abuse are kind of creeping back in. Not that I don't think certain people deserve second chances, but, you know, people have noticed that these kind of injustices have gone on always. And, you know, someone will point it out and maybe there'll be an uproar and people will make a show of, oh, things are wrong, you know, the way that they are now. We need to fix them. But then, you know, the uproar dies down and things just go back to normal and we go to war and do bad things.
Yeah. And I mean, I think Mizoguchi obviously had a investment in this kind of story, you know, throughout his whole career, where he typically showed women, you know, in situations like this where they're suffering at the hands of a male-centered society and having to fall into prostitution often. And we see that a little bit here in Ugetsu. One thing that I found interesting reading about his life was that his father was a roofing carpenter and tried to, you know, get into making a little money by selling raincoats to soldiers during a Russian-Japanese war.
Personal inspiration.
Right. A little. And I mean, obviously, this is based on some stories, too. But as a result of that, the investment flopped and his older sister ended up having to become a geisha and basically sold into prostitution.
Ooh.
So, I mean, you can. And that obviously had a profound effect on him. And, I mean, many of his films are about similar situations. So you definitely see that with Ohama in this film. You know, again, not to give too much away, but I think we'll hold off on the very last reveals and whatnot. But we can get into a little detail there of how Tobai leaves Ohama to pretty much just be subjugated to the will of men, you know, and forced into situations that she would definitely not want to be in.
And he's very blunt and ironic with this, because you kind of cut from these scenes of Tobias sort of falling bass-ackwards in samurai glory.
Right.
It's like, oh, look at this goofy guy. Look at him go. But then it immediately cuts back to her and how grim and awful her situation is, which is directly his fault.
You know,
oh, man, another strength of this movie that I'm just thinking of, and I hate, like, insulting things I like because I love Breaking Bad. A lot of fans of the show hate the wife character, Skyler, because I don't think that the Vince Gilligan who created that show intended this, but she's kind of just there to be like, no, you can't do that to the male protagonist.
Yeah.
And he doesn't really succeed in making her. You shouldn't have to even work to make her sympathetic. Like, her husband is doing awful things and she's the victim of them. But for some reason, a lot of times that character is kind of just put in like this shrew position where, like, because of the film's perspective, you're almost made to go against her.
Mm.
That does not happen in this movie.
I think that's a really interesting comparison. I hadn't thought about Breaking Bad in the context of this and, you know, the same kind of ambition and drive that ultimately destroys a family. But yeah, I like how Miyagi here is presented as just the more wise and content one. And we could talk about like the themes and the background of kind of like Buddhism here, where there's definitely a sense of like, you know, non-materialism coming from her and basically like from the attitude of the film itself and Mizoguchi, where like greed and ambition and gain through war are all seen as terrible things, whereas the kind of message is to be content in what you have, and how he kind of doesn't realize what he has until it's too late. And I really found that impactful and powerful, you know, just reflecting on my own life too, just, you know, being, you know, contentment in the everyday things, and content in what you have, not trying to pursue things beyond your own means.
And I think when you get that sense or feeling from a movie, at least for me, my instinct is to go back and see, like, was I manipulated into feeling that way? Or did this film, you know, like, earn that and give me what felt like an honest experience to bring me to this conclusion? And I think this film definitely does. I think that's why, even though maybe people are starting to forget about it just because of time, that it's still making lists, because I was making fun of some Oscar Best Picture winners that didn't even deserve to be nominated or seen, and Crash was one that came up first. And I mean,
of course,
thematically, that film doesn't hold up. It earns nothing. It's ridiculous. I'm sorry if you're a fan of that film, but it's awful. And it's just bad. This film does, and, you know, I think films that stand the test of time that people aren't making fun of, you know, a few years later, generally earn their greatness, and this movie definitely does.
I guess we could get into any complaints or any, like, little nitpicks that we have. The one thing that it was really only in the beginning where I felt like, okay, this is obviously, like, a moral fable, but it definitely hits you over the head a little bit in the beginning with the greed is bad, ambition is bad, that kind of thing. Like, like I said earlier, Mizuguchi clearly defines his characters in the beginning, but like, and he definitely clearly defines the message, I would argue, but it does feel like a little heavy-handed, you know, just through some of the dialogue of the characters. And I really only felt that way in the beginning. I was like, okay.
Was it specifically with the village chief character?
Yeah, that was probably like the most egregious moment.
Because
yeah.
He really only exists to say those things.
Right.
He's just kind of a cipher that has these wise sayings that he pops in the beginning and the end, and he's done, which again, this is like a very minor slight.
Yeah, it's definitely minor. Because as it shifts towards like the more supernatural, and they, you know, we have to talk about that that scene with the boat on the water, you know, where they go over the lake and find the dead boatman.
Oh,
and how that's just a whole turning point for the film.
That's when it goes into the surreal for sure.
Definitely.
Though when it cuts from, again, the surreal experiences that the men, and particularly
Genjuro
is having, the most surreal, and again, the lighting in these scenes is ridiculous. There are a lot of candlelit scenes, which there's no way they got that much light out of the candle, but I don't know how they did it. It's insane.
Probably lights off to the side. Like I definitely seem to remember a moment where somebody lights a candle and you can kind of tell, like, oh, then they turned on a light, you know, for the film to be able to pick it up.
Thanks a lot, Jordan. But,
no, and I thought that was skillfully done too. I didn't think that was bad.
It's very impressionistic.
Right. Right. It's flowing. It's kind of that chiaroscuro, black and white, just very soft and beautiful.
I love that you pulled that word out of there.
Just right out of there. And yeah, we have to talk about and to be honest, I didn't really even think about this until after reading up on the film, but the reality versus fantasy elements here, where he blends reality and the surreal in such beautiful ways, and just painstakingly just putting together those two things and makes it look so effortless. Where you have some scenes where it almost feels like a documentary of war, you know, of like horrible things happening to these women. And then, but you cut to like the scenes with Lady Wakasa in the manor and like the creepier supernatural stuff going on. And it's
like going to like a post-war Italian film. It's like
right.
You're watching The Bicycle Thief and then you're watching like a live action horror version of Fantasia.
Yeah. those are interesting two to put together. Just even the camera work too. Like there's a scene that we can't really talk about here where one of the women is attacked, and it's shot from above with almost like a documentary feel to it, where it's a little looser, it's less smooth, it's more jittery. We have these two characters in the background.
Cinema verite.
Yeah, it definitely reminds you of like French New Wave or something to come.
Or most recently, the greatest television show of all time, The Shield, which aired on FX from 2000 to 2008.
I know you're a big fan. But then you also have those scenes where we have Lady Wakasa and Genjuro, like, in the bath and out on the, like, having the picnic on the field.
It's
and
so gorgeous, and it's beautiful, but that must have been intentional, right? To juxtapose between, you know, all these fantastical scenes, which are the fantasies, again, of the men.
Yeah.
And then the harsh realism that them enjoying these fantasies has resulted in for the women.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm very excited that you picked this film and that we went here for our first episode. I thought it was a masterpiece myself. Well, you want to do your star ratings? What did I usually do out of 5?
Nice. I usually go out of 10.
Oh,
but
conflict here.
Yeah, I mean, you can make fractions out of it easily. Yeah. I'm really hesitant to give something a 10 unless every aspect of it blows my mind immediately. I would give this a 9 with time. Judging, you know, the discrepancies we had, I think going back and watching it and maybe being able to justify them, I could raise it up to a 10. I don't think I would put it below a 9, though. I think it's just a really resonant movie, you know, just from a filmmaking level and thematically. And we didn't even touch on the acting. The acting is great.
Oh, yeah. All of it. Yeah, everything about it I love. And I was really just hypnotized by this film and just pulled right in. And it went places that I didn't expect, but it totally made sense. Out of 5, I would give it like a 4.5, close to a 5, you know, for sure. Maybe 4.75, but yeah.
I wonder if we're always going to agree.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think so. I think there'll be some differences for sure.
Yeah.
We didn't really talk about Eye of the Duck, which is a segment that we typically will do where we talk about the key scene of the film. But I think we can get more into that with the spoilers, because I feel like I'm going to have to talk about a scene that would spoil the film with the Eye of the Duck segment. So
yeah, there's no way not to.
Yeah, okay. So we got our star ratings. Let's move on to the trivia battle.
I've been nervous this whole time. Let's do it.
So I'm going to ask you a trivia question. If you get it right, then we'll move on to me. And if I get it right, then we'll move on to you and just see who loses first.
Oh, no. So much pressure. So it's like, well, you miss and you're out? It's no, like we're playing like,
well,
the,
if,
like
if you
the
miss,
Game of Force?
If you miss and then I miss, then you get another turn.
Okay.
But if I make it, then, you know, you're out.
Oh, man. Okay. Yeah. All right.
All right. So first question for the trivia battle. Which film earned Stanley Kubrick a Razzie nomination for Worst Director? Was it 2001, Space Odyssey, Eyes Wide Shut, Spartacus, or The Shining?
Oh, no, man. I'm going to go Eyes Wide Shut. No! What was the answer?
Well, the right answer was The Shining. Shining is
you know what? I don't like The Shining at all.
Really?
I always felt like I was in the minority. I think it's a horrible
apparently
movie.
It originally received mixed reviews from critics and audiences alike.
You
so.
Know, Roger Ebert panned it when it came out, and really? I really don't like this. I went back and looked for a negative review, and his is like one of the most prominent ones.
Oh.
I'm stalling.
It's been a while since I've seen it, but I liked it. So you got that one wrong.
That's right.
So now you'll have to ask me a question. This is a page on that site that I have not.
Oh, no, this is so easy.
No, you can flip through there and try.
Why didn't I get this question? This is so easy, too. You ask me the Razzie question, something I purposely avoid. I hate like just focusing on what's terrible.
You can choose whatever question you like.
God dog it. These are all so simple. What would you not know?
I don't know.
I'm trying to think of like. all right. All right. I got to stop. I'm just going to go with a modern movie question.
All right.
All right. In Deadpool, Wade Wilson teams up with Colossus and what other member of the X-Men?
Oh, God. I haven't seen Deadpool.
Cannonball, Jubilee, Wolverine, or Negasonic Teenage Warhead?
I want to say Negasonic Teenage Warhead?
No! God, all of these are so easy!
Nice.
So is that it? It's over?
That's like, it, man.
I don't like that. It's not a battle. It's just like, it's like Revolutionary War battle where everyone just stands apart from each other and shoots once and one person dies, you know? All right. Fine. All right.
You got to be on your game. All right. So, what should I assign you? What I'm thinking is you haven't seen Chungking Express,
and we've
been talking about Asian cinema, so I'd like you to watch Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express from, I believe it's 1994.
I feel like this is very kind of you.
Well, it is, because it's a great film. I hope you enjoy it, and I just want to talk about it with somebody, so that's why I'm going to assign it to you.
Nice. All right. Next time.
Good deal. Well, that's it for our episode today of Film Shake. Hope you guys enjoyed it. You can check us out again on the 25thframemedia.com website. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever you get your podcast. Next time, we're going to discuss my pick, which will be another Mitsuguchi film, The Life of Oharu, which I have not seen either. So we briefly touched on that before, but I think it'll be really fun to just kind of double dip into Mizoguchi and a good excuse to see more of his films.
It's the Empire Strikes Back of Mizoguchi film. No, I really don't. I knew nothing about the movie at all.
Well, yeah, Ugetsu is kind of held up as like his best film, and Life of Oharu is definitely in that latter section of his career that's almost just as renowned, but it'll be kind of interesting to see with The Life of Oharu, is it just as good or not quite as good?
Is it color or black and white?
Oh, it's black and white.
Okay, yeah. Cool. So he didn't get to have that really weird impressionistic final period like Kurosawa did.
What I read was he only directed two films in color out of like over 70 films.
That's
like,
a lot of movies.
He made a lot of movies. A lot of the earlier ones were lost from the silent era, but that latter half of his career, like starting with Life of Oharu, is what he's really regarded for. So, yeah, hope you guys will stick around for episode 2 of Life of Oharu, and we'll be back again with more Film Shake. See you later.
Take it easy.